Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest and greatest episode of Inside the Hexagon. I am your host, as always, Phil Lanides, and I want to welcome you to the show. Alongside me is my co-host, as always, Josh Molina. Josh, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great, Phil, but I have to tell you, the rumors are true. I've signed to fight Jake Paul. I'm going to avenge Ben Askren, and I'm going to make more money than you're paying me. But I got to tell you that it will not interfere with my commitment to this podcast, because I'm only going to train. I'm only going to train for 10 weeks, and I'm only going to get into, you know, slightly okay shape. Come on, you know, Jake Paul needs to be exposed. But as for this show, I have mixed feelings. Features one of the greatest knockouts in MMA history. Mm-hmm. The debut of a great NFL star athlete and just overall great athlete. And a former WWE wrestler. So who's, I guess, now a current wrestler again. But at the time, he was a former wrestler. So I can't complain too much. But I do have a little few things to talk about that we'll get into.
Yeah. No, I really enjoyed this event. So let's jump into it. Before we do, I want to welcome our listeners. Inside the Hexagon is about us walking through the major events, fighters, and milestones of Strikeforce, which was a very important and innovative MMA promotion that existed from 2006 until 2013. On the episode today, we are discussing Strikeforce Miami, the promotion's first event in the Sunshine State. In short, this was an event full of firsts. I mean, there was two huge debuts on the card, as Josh alluded to there. 47-year-old College Football Hall of Famer and former NFL star Herschel Walker made his MMA debut, and former WWE star, as again Josh mentioned, Bobby Lashley fought in Strikeforce for the first time. In addition, Chris Cyborg would make the first defense of her Strikeforce women's featherweight title, and there would be an inaugural Strikeforce welterweight champion as Nick Diaz and Marius Soromskis would tangle for the title. So this was a big one, and I definitely enjoyed it. So I'm looking forward to getting into this. It's definitely an event that is full of firsts, and I thought it was an important one. So I'm glad that we're getting into it today. But I also want to mention Inside the Hexagon is a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. You can check out their other shows on the network at evergreenpodcast.com, and they've got some really cool stuff there. But with that, let's jump in. Fallout from Evolution, which was the last Strikeforce event. Biggest news coming out of there was definitely Gilbert Melendez getting revenge on Josh Thompson and becoming the undisputed Strikeforce lightweight champion. It also meant El Nino had avenged his only two career losses. In addition, Scott Smith had come back from a two-round drubbing to knock out a returning Kung Lee in the third round, the miracle in San Jose, as Mauro Ranallo called it on, I said Ronaldo, Ranallo called it on commentary. Truly one of the great comebacks in MMA history. And for you fans out there, Josh interviewed Scott Smith on our latest episode before this one, so make sure that you check that out in the archives. Josh, I really enjoyed your chat with Scott. I mean, such a good dude and just like a regular guy that he knows where he stands in MMA history. He knows that he's not one of the, you know, like greatest, but knows that he had his moments. And I just, you know, hey, he's moved on with his life and he's enjoying life up in Oregon. And I thought it was really cool that I really enjoyed that interview. So fans, make sure you check that out if you haven't already. But that was
cool. Thanks, Phil. I mean, he's definitely a stereotype cliche, but he's exactly the kind of guy you'd want to, you know, just have a beer with. I mean, he's just a straight shooter, and I think it comes across in the interview.
Absolutely. So make sure you check that out if you haven't already. Jacare Silva I am like tripping all over my words today. He made a Strikeforce debut, submitting Matt Lindland in the first round, cementing the Brazilian as a player in Strikeforce's middleweight division. And then finally, Strikeforce had a new star on its hands in King Mo, who had knocked out Mike Whitehead in the first round. The charismatic moneyweight, as he called himself, had then gotten fined for spraying energy drink all over the cage in celebration of his win. For a guy that was so big on making money, he apparently didn't mind getting fined for his antics. But yeah, we'll be talking more about King Mo as we go along. Jumping back now into getting the preparation for Strikeforce Miami underway on December 11th, 2009, it was announced that 33-year-old former WWE star Bobby Lashley had signed with Strikeforce. It was also revealed that he would make his Hexagon debut at the January 30th event in Miami. Undefeated at 4-0 in MMA, he had most recently stopped Bob Sapp at an event in Biloxi, Mississippi. Do you, Josh, I'm taking a wild guess here that you probably never saw that fight. Did you ever see that?
No, I can't even. It's like King Kong versus Godzilla. I mean, that must be a colossal matchup.
It's not. It's embarrassing. Not, no. Oh, okay. It's embarrassing. It's Bob Sapp just folded up like a cheap suit, as you would expect. So, God, I hope he never listens to this, because he will. If he, I don't know where he is, but he will kill me.
Phil, after I take out Jake Paul, I'll take out Bob Sapp for you. Don't worry.
Thanks,
about
buddy.
It. I got you covered. Okay.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate that. We will rename this podcast in remembrance of you.
Yeah, we really hope he never listens to it now. Yeah.
Now he's gunning for both of us. It's one of us has to survive. We got to keep this thing going. But Lashley was a former Army and collegiate wrestler. He'd been released by WWE in 2008, headed over to TNA, which he was still active there at the time of his signing with Strikeforce. But this was definitely a big deal for Strikeforce. I mean, despite his lack of promo skills, Lashley obviously had a fantastic look. And, I mean, looks probably better today than he did back then. He held several titles while he was in WWE. I mean, they really tried to make him into a big star. But, you know, he just, I don't know, just didn't really have that it factor, in my opinion. And I still don't think he does. I mean, that's why I think it's great that MVP is with him. The signing had some mainstream appeal for sure. So we'll talk more about Lashley. Then in the main event of Strikeforce's Miami event, it was going to be Nick Diaz versus Marius Zaromskis colliding for the inaugural Strikeforce welterweight title. That was, as I mentioned earlier, Diaz was, of course, a very established star, while Zaromskis was not a name that was really well known then and is not really remembered by many today, but he was a very talented fighter. He was coming off a strong run in Dream's welterweight Grand Prix, and he had actually earned Dream's welterweight title, so this was a big deal. But I did read that having Diaz fight in Florida would be easier than him fighting in California, as the Florida State Boxing Commission, which oversaw MMA in the Sunshine State, did not require pre-fight tests for, quote, drugs of abuse, which is what marijuana was classified as by many athletic commissions at the time. So it seemed to be potentially a strategic move having Nick fight in Florida. And by the way, as we record this, last night was UFC 261, which saw Strikeforce veteran Jorge Masvidal get knocked out by Kamaru Usman in the main event, and former Strikeforce fighter Anthony Smith won by TKO, coming by way of a leg kick in the opening match on the card. So strong Strikeforce representation on that event. But Dana White announced afterwards that Nick Diaz is definitely coming back to fight in 2021. So that's exciting. And if I have my druthers, I want to see a rematch between Nick and Robbie Lawler. I loved that first fight. Josh, did you see the first fight? I think it was 2004, maybe 2006, but it was somewhere in the mid 2000s. Did you ever see that?
Yeah. I mean, that I remember like being an MMA fan and then finding out those two had fought and being like, no way, those guys fought. And so I remember going back and watching that. I don't know if you've seen Nick Diaz, but like,
oh dude, he's in fantastic shape. Yeah. He's a triathlete, dude. Like that guy, he's got that V thing going on with his, you know, his, whatever, I don't know, is what do you call that? I don't even know what you call that, but the V thing at his waist, you know, where like guys are really in shape, like, dude, he's all tanned. And I mean, dude, he looks fantastic. So
yeah, I mean, he's always been kind of a skinny fat kind of dude, you know,
he's in good shape,
but like right now he looks like incredible. Like it's amazing. Dude,
he hasn't fought since 2015, man. It's been 6 years. So this is kind of crazy, but I'm excited. Anytime Nick Diaz is going to fight, I'm down. I want to see that. So good stuff there. But anyways, bringing it back to the end of 2009, a few days before Christmas, it was announced that Chris Cyborg would defend her Strikeforce women's featherweight title against Marluz Kunin. This fight had been expected since Kunin had recently defeated Roxanne Modafferi in Strikeforce, earning herself that initial shot at Chris Cyborg. And then on New Year's Eve, it was revealed that Jay Heron and Joe Riggs would battle, with the winner likely to get the first shot at Strikeforce's new welterweight champion. In addition, an extremely intriguing middleweight matchup was added, with ruthless Robbie Lawler, who we just discussed, slated to lock horns with fellow knockout artist Melvin Manhoef. And I mean, just seeing that, if they were to fight today, I would be excited about that fight. I mean, that's just two killers right there. But then finally, really the big news from this was Herschel Walker. I mean, he would be making his MMA debut at Strikeforce Miami, and this was a big, big deal. I mean, his list of accomplishments, second to none: 1982 Heisman Trophy winner, three-time All-American at the University of Georgia, widely considered to be the greatest, still to this day, considered to be the greatest college football player of all time, a college football Hall of Famer. He also, dude, He made the U.S. Olympic bobsled team in 1992 while still active in the NFL. I mean, that's just like crazy athlete right there, you know? I mean, that's just insane. And he's also, his NFL career was never, you know, what his college career was. I mean, he put some miles on his body in the USFL, but he was part of, I believe he was part of the trade. It was like one of the biggest trades in NFL history, and it laid the foundation for the Cowboys eventually getting like Emmitt Smith, I think Troy Aikman. Like it basically set them up to be the team of the 90s, basically. But a little footnote there.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it sounds like you're describing Tim Tebow here when you're talking about the greatest college football player of all time. You know, hey, I don't see Herschel Walker trying to hit a baseball. I mean, that's the hardest thing to do in sports. No, I'm just joking. Obviously, a huge coup, a major deal. We're going to talk about it. 47 years old.
Amazing.
That's unreal.
And the shape he was in when you saw him in the cage, mm-hmm. it's
he's a vegetarian. All he does is push-ups. Like, he's like the craziest, freakest athlete. You know?
He's one of those guys, it's genetics. You know, I'm like, I know he works hard. I'm not trying to take away from that. But there's, dude, if I did what he did, if I worked as hard as he did, I still would not be, you know, anywhere near that. So he's just a freak athlete that worked really, really hard and, you know, got everything he deserved for sure. But I wanted to mention Strikeforce was certainly looking to get as much firepower out of having a world-class athlete like Herschel Walker appear in its cage. And that the Hall of Famer did tons of media leading up to the fight, including four separate appearances on four different shows in one day on ESPN. So this was a really big coup for the promotion. But during those media appearances, Walker expressed his desire to see MMA become an Olympic sport, which has definitely been mentioned off and on over the years. And I'm, you know, look, it's pretty ridiculous that a quote sport like curling makes the cut, you know, but not MMA. But as we record this just a few weeks ago, jiu-jitsu is going to be included as a sport in the 2024 Olympics, which I'm really excited about. And I think that's long overdue. So, you know, maybe MMA isn't far behind. And any thoughts on that, Josh?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, MMA is so, I mean, obviously it's come a long way, but when I think of the Olympics, I think of the pure athleticism behind these people who compete, and there's a lot of subjectivity in MMA. I just don't know how that would be. I don't know. I don't know how they would judge it, how they would score it. I think it's ripe for the wrong people to win. I mean, we've obviously seen boxing, which is the most comparable thing. These horrible decisions. They have computers that sort of like add up the points, but there's a little bit of an X factor. So I don't know. I mean, if it's like pure MMA, I mean, we're going to see the wrestlers sort of dominating. I mean, is it a knockout? I don't know. Jiu-jitsu, I think that's fantastic. I think that's perfect. That's, you know, we have judo. Why not jiu-jitsu? That's great. I think MMA might be too violent to be an Olympic sport. I don't know.
You know, that's an interesting point because boxing, they, you know, they wear the headgear and you don't see a ton of really brutal knockouts in Olympic boxing. So, you know, that's an interesting point. It really is. But obviously nobody that's with the UFC would be, you know, would be part of this. They all have to be amateur athletes, right?
Yeah.
Oh, well, although, hey, NBA, I mean, it was 92 was the first year that they allowed pro players to be able to play for their teams, and they still do. So why wouldn't you be able to do that for, you know, MMA fighters today? So I would think a guy like Dana would fight against this, because then you might see like pay-per-view matchups that you want to set up,
right?
You know, yeah. or Bellator, you know, like some of these Russians in Bellator that are part of like Fedor's team that are just, you know, taking all the belts. And, you know, now we got UFC versus Bellator, which all the fans want to see, but Dana, you know, probably doesn't want to see that. So I hadn't really thought about that. I was just like, yeah, come on. These other comparable sports are doing it. Why not MMA? But I guess it's more complicated than that.
So you want to, does anybody want to see Conor McGregor go win a freaking gold medal? I mean, give me a break. That's
that's a good point.
And some of the MMA guys, they'd go in there and tear it up just like the NBA people do. But I just don't know how you do it. It's so violent and it would just disrupt, I think. Now, if you had pure amateur athletes on the rise, that's one thing. You know, I could see that. But having the pro people do it, I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see what happens. But anyways, back to where we're at. About a week before the event, Bobby Lashley finally had his opponent confirmed. I read that it was supposed to be Shane Del Rosario, and then it was supposed to be Johan Banks, and that fight was not approved by the Florida Athletic Commission. Then veteran fighter Jimmy Ambrose got the call, but he was removed for unknown reasons. Instead, about a week before, it was confirmed that UFC and tough veteran Wes Sims would be taking that slot. And, you know, not an elite fighter by any means at all, but Sims was experienced and very entertaining, so this was going to be a good test for Lashley for sure. And lastly, the day of the event, EA Sports announced that Diaz, Zoromskis, Riggs, Manhoef, and Lashley had all been added as playable fighters to the EA Sports MMA game. Those five joined a host of others already announced, including Fedor, Randy Couture, Frank Shamrock, Gegard Mousasi, Babalu, Shinya Aoki, Jake Shields, King Mo, Kung Lee, Mayhem Miller, Gilbert Melendez, Josh Thompson, Robbie Lawler, Scott Smith, and others. So I was somewhat involved in that game. I tried to get sponsors for one of the fighters, and I was in constant contact with some of the EA guys and just working on I mean, I didn't have anything to do with putting the game together, but trying to get sponsors for some fighters and that sort of thing. And I just remember being really, really excited about it. The game did not do very well overall, but it was pretty exciting at the time to be able to see something that's not UFC branded like that. So
Scott Smith is in an MMA game. I gotta play this game. That is correct.
Yeah, you can find it. I don't know if they've got a gaming system it'll work on now, but yeah, you can find it. But all right, so UFC champions at the time of this event, bantamweight and featherweight champions will be crowned in late 2010, so not too far off from when from the event that we're talking about. But BJ Penn, still the lightweight champion. GSP, still the welterweight champion. Anderson Silva, still the middleweight champ. Lyoto Machida, still the light heavyweight champ. And Brock Lesnar, still the undisputed heavyweight champion. The closest UFC event to this was UFC 109. It took place at the Mandalay Bay Event Center in Las Vegas, Nevada, drawing 10,753 fans for a gate of $2.273 million, along with a buy rate of $275,000 on pay-per-view. On the main card, Matt Serra defeated Strikeforce veteran Frank Trigg via first-round TKO. Damian Maia beat Dan Miller via unanimous decision, and Chael Sonnen also beat Nate Marquardt via unanimous decision, earning Sonnen a shot against middleweight kingpin Anderson Silva, one of my favorite fights of all time. I loved the first Chael Sonnen Anderson Silva fight. I mean, I was like, oh, dude, I was like, oh, my God, he's going to do it. He's going to do it. He's going to do it. And then Silva pulled off that submission at the end. And, oh, man, I remember I was at my parents' house watching that, I think with my brother-in-law, and I just, oh, we could not believe what we had just seen. That was one of the most exciting fights and finishes. I love that fight. So
I mean, God hates Chael Sonnen.
Yeah,
I mean,
seriously.
Well, he was good, so close.
He is the bad guy, though, so, you know. But anyways.
It would have been overturned anyway had he won.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, because he tested positive, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so good stuff. But then in the main event, very interesting, featured two UFC Hall of Fame inductees facing each other for the very first time. This is the first time this happened in the UFC. Randy Couture submitted Mark Coleman via second-round technical submission, coming by way of rear naked choke. Couture and Coleman, two UFC pioneers, were actually scheduled to fight at UFC 17 all the way back in 1998. So a good 11 year or 12 years prior to when it actually happened, but Couture got injured, and so that scuttled that. The closest Strikeforce Challenger event to the Miami event was Kaufman versus Hashi, I'm not sure how to say that. It took place on February 26th at the San Jose Civic Auditorium, so almost a full month after this Miami event. There were several notable names on the card. Current UFC fighter Yancy Medeiros defeated Raul Castillo via unanimous decision, while future Strikeforce welterweight champion Tarek Saffiedine beat James Terry by unanimous decision. And then Josh's favorite fighter of all time, the one and only Luke Rockhold, ran his record to 7-1 when he TKO'd Paul Bradley with knees to the body. And then an unfortunate occurrence took place in the co-main event. Trevor Prangley and Carl Amusu battled to a technical draw, which was declared after Prangley accidentally thumbed Amusu in the eye. The Frenchman was unable to continue, ending the bout. And then in the main event, Sarah Kaufman beat Takeo Hashi via unanimous decision to become the first ever Strikeforce Women's Bantamweight Champion. So this is weird. Strikeforce decided to headline a challenger's bout in front of, if they're lucky, a couple thousand people with an inaugural title. Why? Like, you're wanting to establish a new champion in a new division, so you put it on without a TV broadcast in front of a relatively small crowd. Like, this just that did not make any sense to me, and it doesn't say much about Strike Force's and Josh or Scott Coker's confidence in the women's bantamweight decision they were just getting going. But maybe I'm missing something here. Josh, you have any thoughts?
Well, I mean, the only thing I could think of is they were just experimenting. Maybe they were trying to draw a larger house by having this title match and just sort of seeing, you know, what Sarah Kaufman could do with a live crowd. You know, maybe somebody just decided to just, you know, they made a mistake. It happens. I will say Sarah Kaufman is not the most thrilling fighter in the world.
No, she's not.
So it is possible that she was just overlooked and they didn't think it would be a television draw, and it was what it was. But it is unfortunate because Strikeforce and Ronda obviously get a lot of credit. Misha Tate, Cyborg, Marlis Conan for being sort of the pioneers of women's MMA. But here they kind of hid this championship match. So
yeah,
I would just say it's a mistake.
Yeah, that's how it feels. It feels like they hit it. So, but anyways, all right, well, let's get to Strike Force Miami itself. It took place on January 30th, 2010 at the Bank Atlantic Center in Sunrise, Florida. One of the fights was scheduled to be broadcasted on EASportsMMA.com to promote the video game, but did not. More on that in a bit. Once again, the commentators would be Mauro Ranallo, Frank Shamrock, and Steven Quadros, while Jimmy Lennon Jr. would be back as the ring announcer. 7,010 fans, 4,927 of them paid, were in attendance, paying a gate of $301,425. The main card was broadcasted on Showtime, drawing an estimated 517,000 viewers. Before we get into the undercard, I did want to mention, just before I forget, I really thought that Steven Quadros was really coming more into his own, that, as you know, these three I felt were gelling pretty well, and that there was, you know, that first one I didn't feel like Quadros really fit in or did, you know, did super well, but I felt like they were gelling, the three of them, and that there was a real rapport there. So I enjoyed the commentary more on this one, definitely more than their first one.
But and he wore a lot less makeup.
He did have less makeup on, for sure. He looked less cadaver-like, for sure. So that was good. But the undercard, only a couple fights we're going to touch on, or you were going to speak to at all really here. But opening bout, 170 pounds, Michael Burns defeated Dave Zitanic via majority decision. At 185 pounds, Jeffrey Caccia defeated Matt Cooper via KO, coming by way of punches at 226 of the second round. Third fight, 170 pounds, Joe Ray defeated John Clark via TKO, coming by way of punches at 314 of the first round. John Clark makes me think of John Clark from NYPD Blue, one of my all-time favorite shows. That was the Mark Paul Gosselaar character from Saved by the Bell. But yeah, anyways, I didn't even think about it as I read it, and then I said it out loud, I'm like, oh, John Clark.
Well, since you brought it up, I mean, are you watching the Saved by the Bell revival?
I am not watching it, but I am listening to the Mark Paul Gosselaar podcast with, what's the guy's name? Dashiell something. He's one of the writers for the renewed one, and they're going through the original episodes of Saved by the Bell.
And that's
one by
nice.
One. And Gosselaar has never watched the show before. He has never, ever watched the show.
Well, I don't believe that. Come
on. He's never. He said it's embarrassing to him, not because he's embarrassed about the show, but he says himself, like, he's, you know, just watching himself as an awkward teenager is really embarrassing for him. So he just doesn't watch. He has never watched any of the episodes. So so he's going through these, like, essentially kind of blind, and he's like, I don't remember a lot of it. So Dashiell does a lot of research, but they've had Mario Lopez has been on, Elizabeth Berkley, you know, Jesse Spano, she's been on, Tiffany Amber Theisen, Kelly Kapow, she's been on, and then they've had like a bunch of like secondary people on, like they had Ed Alonzo, who played the magician Max, like he was on, just some care, like they just covered this really famous episode with a nurse. And where like Zach falls in love with the nurse, and they had the nurse on. So like it's I really enjoy it. Like it's, you know, I really enjoy going, because I was a huge fan of the show growing up. Now it's really a terrible show. Like it's really not like a
it's an amazing show.
It is not. It is a very like poor quality show, and you can see when they go through, and they're just like, Why? Like this gaping plot hole or this, you know, gape, like this just does not make sense at all. And they call it out and, you know, so they're, you know, they're, yeah.
Plus
Zach Morse is truly trash. So there, he's not a good human being. Like he's really not a good dude. He secretly took pictures of his female friends in bathing suits and then made a calendar out of it and sold them. Well, you know, like, person.
You can't use today's moral standards to judge what happened in the 90s. Okay. First of all, if I were ever cast with Tiffany Amber Thiessen, I would watch that show 100,000,000,000 times. And come on, it's Kelly Kapowski. I don't understand. I mean, they went to prom together? How does he not watch the show? I mean,
he just never got into it.
Did they get into Screech at all? How they totally turned on him and then he drops it? No?
He wrote that book, like the tell-all book, which then he told them that like he actually had very little to do with it and he just needed the money and that sort of thing. And they were talking about like possibly having him on the renewal, and then, you know, sadly he passed away really quickly, and they did like kind of a really long retrospective on him for the podcast and that sort of thing. So, you know, Gosler, he doesn't go into like dirty details or anything like that, and he said they all got along for the most part, and he doesn't get into who dated who, and, you know, he's not interested in trying to like do that kind of stuff. So, which I, you know, yeah, there's a part of me that wants to hear that stuff, but I kind of appreciate that. Like, I'm not looking to hear a bunch of dirty laundry, to be honest with you. There's enough negativity out there. So, but John Clark lost by TKO by punches at 3:14 of the first round to Joe Ray. At 155 pounds, David Gomez defeated Craig Oxley via unanimous decision. 145 pound fight, Pablo Alfonso defeated Marcos De Mata via submission, coming by way of armbar at 147 of the first round. And then at 170 pounds, Haider Hassan defeated Ryan Keenan via KO, coming by way of punch at 242 of the second round. Hassan would go on to compete on two different seasons of The Ultimate Fighter, and he's actually technically still an active fighter. I think he last fought in 2019. At 170 pounds, John Kelly defeated Sabah Humasi via submission, coming by way of rear naked choke at 248 of the second round. I did want to mention Sabah Humasi is a current Bellator fighter and actually just got finished by Paul Daly at a recent Bellator event. The reason I laughed is because John Kelly was the David Caruso character on NYPD Blue in the first season. So, and essentially John Clark's character, because he was Andy Sipowicz's first partner on the show, and then John Clark was Andy's fourth on the show. So essentially John Clark is like a replacement for, you know, the replacement for the replacement of John Kelly. So it's ironic that both of these two NYPD alum fought on this card.
I'm just happy that I was not even expecting to be thinking about Tiffany Amber Thiessen. You made it happen. So
get your head back in the
game. The rest of the show is fine. Whatever happens.
Okay. All right. And then in the kind of, you know, as I call it, the main event of the undercard, Jay Heron defeated Joe Riggs via unanimous decision. As a reminder, the winner of this bout would likely be the first challenger for whoever won the title in the night's main event. If that was Riggs and then Diaz won, it would have set up a long-awaited rematch for these two from their previous UFC fight, which Riggs had won. But then, as detailed during our interview episode with Joe Riggs, which is available in the archives, the two got in a fight at the hospital afterwards. It's an insane story. Make sure you check it out, InsideTheHexagon.com, or you can just download, you know, go back in our archives and download it from wherever you get your podcasts. But anyways, Huron was 18-4 coming in. He had won six straight fights dating back 2.5 years. He had made a Strikeforce debut at Carano versus Cyborg, beating UFC vet Jesse Taylor by unanimous decision. Riggs, at 32-10, was also on a winning streak, having been victorious in four straight, which included Strikeforce wins over Luke Stewart and Phil Baroni. This, I could not find video for this. It was supposed to be broadcasted on EASportsMMA.com, as I mentioned, but an overloaded server went down, preventing fans from seeing the scrap. That really sucks, because you have enough interest in your fight to crash a server, and which means nobody sees it. So that sucked. But MMA Weekly provided commentary on the action, so we do that, have that here. Fans got pretty restless in the first round, but things really began to pick up in the third. Riggs landed a punch before Huron got a takedown, and he cut Diesel in the process, Later in the round, Huron landed a shot that dropped Riggs, and I saw a picture, and Riggs was a bloody mess. I mean, he looked really bad, and in the end, Huron won a pretty dominant decision, it looked like. But after the fight, neither Huron nor Riggs would fight on a major Strikeforce event again. Riggs would beat Lewis Taylor at a Challengers event later in the year, while Huron would move on to Bellator after this bout. Huron would have runs with both Bellator and the UFC before hanging up the gloves in 2013 with a 23-6 record. He's now an actor and a stuntman. I know he's in the first Equalizer movie. He fights Denzel Washington in a car in a pretty cool scene. So if you want to check that out, he's
Mark Gosselaar in that one too?
No, he's not. Neither is John Kelly or John Clark or any of them. But Riggs, of course, is still active, and he's looking to wrap up his career. We talked about that in our interview with him, and he's been doing some bare knuckle fighting and that sort of thing. He's, I believe, recovering from an injury right now, but I think he's looking to wrap up his career. Not quite ready to be done, but he's getting there. But anyways, on to the main card. In the opening bout of the main card, and these videos are available on UFC Fight Pass if you want to see these fights. In a heavyweight bout, Bobby Lashley defeated Wes Sims via TKO, coming by way of punches at 206 of the first round. Lashley, of course, as we discussed, had been a major star, or not a major star, but he'd been a star in WWE, though many would say he hadn't reached his potential with a lack of charisma and speaking skills holding him back. After a run with the promotion, he'd been released and subsequently did some independent shows before signing with TNA, where he was still technically active as he entered into MMA. In MMA, he was undefeated at 4-0. He was supposed to face Ken Shamrock in his second fight, but Shamrock tested positive for steroids. No, I don't believe it.
At least they cut his eye training before the fight.
Yeah. Well, that would have been better than testing positive for steroids before the fight. But Lashley fought Clay Guida's big brother Jason instead and beat him. And then in his third fight, Lashley took on Strikeforce vet Mike Cook and submitted him with a 24-second guillotine choke. And this was interesting. Apparently, Cook had irritated Lashley by wearing a luchador mask to the cage. And afterwards, Lashley said, quote, "I'm here for business. I'm here and everyone wants to and tries to make fun of the wrestling thing. I'm real. If they want to play around, I'll knock them out or choke them out." And that's what I did. I choked him out and made him pay. Now he can go put the mask back on and have fun with himself, end quote. See, I'm like, dude, if that Lashley had showed up in WWE, maybe it would have been a different story that first time around. But Sims, at 23-12-1, was a charismatic, if underwhelming, fighter at 6'8". He had height, but he wasn't particularly agile or powerful. But a Hammerhouse product who had trained under Mark Coleman, Sims had a controversial run in the UFC from 2003 to 2004. During that time, he'd been DQ'd in a fight against Frank Shamrock for stomping on his face while he was on the mat, which was illegal, which I remember that fight. Not only did he stomp on his face, he actually had his hands on top of the cage. Remember, he was 6'8", and was stomping down on Mir's face. I remember Mir's, like, jaw and, like, just, it was pretty ugly. And Mir didn't get up, like, all angry. Like, he was really hurt. So they DQ'd Sims, and Sims got the loss there, and then they were rematched, but Sims broke his arm, and the fight was postponed. And once they did fight again, Mir knocked him out in the second round. And then after that, Sims had faced Mike Kyle, who bit Sims on the pec while he was caught in a guillotine choke.
Oh man.
The ref didn't catch it, and Sims was stopped with punches at 4:59 of the first round. And I remember where the fighters are, the refs holding the fighters' wrists and about to raise their hands, and you can see the bite mark on his pec. Like, Sims is pointing to his chest. I mean, like, dude, this is BS. That dude bit me. So, but Sims was technically coming off 3 straight wins, but that didn't include getting choked out by Justin Wren on season 10 of The Ultimate Fighter the previous year, since that was a quote, they look at those as exhibition fights. But Sims was taking the fight on a week's notice and was not in great shape, and it showed.
I feel like if you get bit on your pec in an MMA fight, like, all bets are off. Like, I think you can fight back. I mean, I just think that's so unfair. You know, if somebody does that, I think you need to fight back and, you know, not count on the referees to do that. But then again, it is Mike Kyle, so I guess people learn to expect that. I do want to talk a little bit about Sims and Lashley, and this is from the Wrestling Observer, the newsletter at the time. You know, we're sort of talking about how Lashley was the pro wrestler, ex-pro wrestler at the time, but the Wrestling Observer notes that Sims was the one with the personality. I'm going to read directly here. The funny part is that Sims was the guy running around playing pro wrestler all weekend. Sims, who has done some indie wrestling and tried out for WWE in 2004 without getting picked, came off last season of The Ultimate Fighter, where he was always in his Brutus Beefcake character. Here he was more playing big bully, showing up with a big scowl and with sunglasses on. He made a sing in the ring after the stoppage. He went to the post-show press conference and looked like he was shooting an angle for TNA, shoving Lashley, challenging him to another fight, and then doing press interviews saying Lashley illegally grabbed his throat, saying that Lashley is going to be back working security because he doesn't cut good enough promos to make it in pro wrestling, and made steroid accusations against Lashley. So that's a little interesting, you know, backstory that this Sims guy was quite the character.
Yeah, he definitely was. He had more personality than Lashley, you know, that's for sure. But it did not do him any good in this fight. Sims, who, by the way, was wearing, like, the tight shorts, like, not, dude, bad. No, bad. Just not a good look. But this would be pretty quick. Solid, if easy, takedown for Lashley early on. Some good right hands from top position for the former WWE star. Sims had a decent guard, but Lashley was in full control, and he started dropping some heavy right hands. And after Sims turned his back, the ref stopped the fight. It might have been a little premature, and Sims did protest, like Meltzer said there, but it was more due to Lashley having him by the throat while he was punching him. And, you know, the ref had warned him several times about the had warned Lashley about grabbing him. And then, you know, Sims, I really think Sims had a point. I don't think it would have changed anything. Like, he wasn't, it was more like he had his thumb on, like, the side of his throat. It's not like he had his hand, like, wrapped around his throat and was holding him there. But, you know, you're not allowed to do that. But if he had slipped his thumb down 3 inches, it would have been like on his chest and it would have been fine. So yeah, it was, I, you know, he had a point technically, but I don't think it changed the fight at all.
Yeah. Well, you know, my biases, Phil, Sims was just too out of shape for me to take him seriously. I mean, you're going in there against Lashley. You got to come in better shape. Now, I know he took the fight on short notice, but if you're an MMA fighter, I mean, you can't be walking into the cage with creases in your back. I mean, you need to stay in better shape. And he's a big guy, but, I mean, you've already lost the fight. I mean, you're going in there against Lashley. I mean, Lashley's like, there's no way this guy's going to beat me. And obviously, bodies are not always an indicator of how well you fight. But if you're taking on, like, a collegiate wrestler, and you're taking a guy on that looks like that, I mean, you're done. You have no chance. If you're not in shape yourself. And Lashley took him down with ease. Can you give me a break with that takedown early in the round? And the guy just folded up. I realize he's tall, but he didn't really put up any resistance. And this guy was way below even Bobby Lashley's level at this time. This guy was way below it.
Yeah, I don't disagree with any of that. I really thought it was a pretty poor showing, and it just seemed like a paycheck, you know? So, but anyways, Lashley would be back in Strikeforce later in the year. Sims would be one and done in Strikeforce. He would try to rematch Tim Sylvia later in 2010, but the first attempt was aborted when the Athletic Commission rejected the bout, and the second fell through when the event was canceled. Sims beat fellow Strikeforce vet Warpath Villarreal in a Gladiator Challenge bout in 2013 and ended his career on a loss in 2016 to leave his final record at 24-15-1. I did not know that he had tried out for WWE, but I definitely think he would have been a better fit for pro wrestling than MMA. But anyways, then at 185 pounds, Robbie Lawler defeated Melvin Manhoef via KO coming by way of punch at 333 of the first round. Lawler had, of course, at 16-5, made his Strikeforce debut in June 2009 against Jake Shields, losing by submission in the first round. He was originally slated to appear on the last Strikeforce card of 2009, but an injury to Trevor Prangley at the last minute didn't allow the organization time to find a suitable replacement, so the bout was scrapped and he was moved to this January event instead. Manhoef, at 24-6-1, was coming into this fight fresh off a first-round win over former Pride middleweight Grand Prix champion Kazuo Misaki on New Year's Eve in Japan. Manhoef was a successful kickboxer who had some big wins in his MMA career. He actually made his MMA debut all the way back in 1995. And this dude is still fighting today, so pretty crazy. But he had vicious knockouts in 2008 of Mark Hunt and Kazushi Sakuraba, and I looked those up. They were brutal. Like, the Sakuraba one, he just ran him over, and, like, it was pretty brutal. The Mark Hunt one, which Hunt outweighed him by probably 50 pounds easy, like, maybe even more than that. I mean, it was – Hunt's a big dude. And he hit him with this left and then this right and just put Hunt's lights out. So Manhoef carried a lot of power. I mean, the guy had dynamite in his fist. So this one, you know, really had violence written all over it. But, you know, as we get into the fight, oftentimes when you match up two killers like this, the fight can actually end up being pretty boring because neither fighter wants to take a risk. But that was not the case here at all. I was excited to watch this fight even knowing what was going to happen. But it was all fireworks. And, yeah, I'd be excited to see this fight even today. I would still be excited to see this fight. But Moro pointed out that seven of Lawler's victories had come inside the opening round, while 20 of Manhoef's had come in the opening frame, which is just crazy. But as they got started, good body and leg kicks from Manhoef early on as the two felt things out. And, Josh, I wanted to ask, did you see Lawler pretend like he was hurt to draw Manhoef in? Like he did that thing where he kind of like danced away and like kind of rolled his head like he was hurt. Did you catch that?
Yeah, I saw him do that. And I think it might have been Quadros who also said, or maybe Ronaldo, very uncharacteristic of Lawler.
It wasn't gamesmanship. He wasn't trying to show him up. I think he was trying to draw him in.
Yeah, he's trying to get him in, you know, to counterpunch him or something like that. But, you know, Robbie Lawler, you know, he doesn't joke around like that in fights. So it was kind of funny to see him do it, for sure.
Yeah, I really think he was trying to make Manhoef think he was injured. So, but Manhoef started opening up he was tenderizing Lawler's lead right leg. And Lawler was clearly hurting. He switched stances, but he was just getting picked apart. And this was a repeat of the Lawler-Pete Spratt fight. Where Ruthless was getting leg kicked so much that he ended up getting injured, and that was the end of the fight. I mean, you should look that, if you haven't seen that, you should look that up because it's pretty crazy. But all of a sudden, I mean, it was all Manhoef, and then all of a sudden it was over. Manhoef kicked Lawler's right leg again so hard that Lawler switched stances in this very smooth move, and then he shot out this, like, overhand right that stunned Manhoef, and Lawler sees he's hurt, rushes in, lands a left hook uppercut that just shuts the lights out. And Manhoef was out. His eyes were rolled into the back of his head. They were open. He was asleep. And it took a long time for him to get up. And Lawler was clearly hurt. I mean, he was limping very noticeably. Immediately went over and shook hands and bowed in respect to Manhoef's team, which I thought was really, you know, obviously very classy. The fight stats showed that Lawler literally landed one standing strike and one ground strike. And they were the two that finished the fight. And Mauro brought up the miracle in San Jose, and I was thinking the same thing. I mean, it was pretty much the Kung Lee Smith fight, the Kung Lee Scott Smith fight inside of one round instead of three. But what a comeback. One of my all-time favorite Strikeforce fights. Josh, what did you think?
Well, thank God that for Lawler's sake that he knocked him out, because if had he not, I don't know that he'd be around today. I mean, Manhoef was just killing him with these legs, like to the point where Robbie was going to collapse. I mean, he was swinging his legs back and forth.
I don't think he would have lasted much longer. I really don't.
Yeah. No, there was no way he was going to keep standing up. He would have fallen, and then it would have been a ground and pound kind of thing. But, I mean, it was actually kind of cool to watch somebody who was that good. You know, Manhoef was so good with his leg strikes, and Lawler just had nothing to do but just sit there and take them. And Lawler's a tough guy. But the thing is, Lawler had not been hit in the head in any of this. It was physical pain, and I'm sure it was maddening, but his head was clear. And so Manhoef, you know, he smells blood and he's going in there, but he's going in there against a guy whose legs are killing him, but his head is fine. So he can still think about counterpunching. And Manhoef got a little bit reckless. He got a little bit overeager, and he rushed in trying to take out Lawler because he saw that he was hurt. And Lawler is just timing him. He's just looking. He's like, if I can hit this guy before he hits me one more time, I'm going to take him out. So even though he was in trouble, he was all there mentally in this game. So he just knocked him. I mean, he basically, Manhoff was stuck between that space between life and death. I mean, he was like trying to rise. He was trying to get up. His body was like, he couldn't. It's like he had sleep paralysis or something. Like his eyes were open, but he couldn't move. And it was kind of scary, actually. He just, his eyes were bugging out and he looked really bad. And then Lawler's pounded on him and the referee's got to tackle Lawler and like get him out of there. That was kind of cool. He jumped in there, rolled with him. And as you said, Manhoff was down for several minutes. A lot of times guys get knocked out bad, you know, and they're up 10 seconds later. Not this case. And
no.
Lawler, of course, was still limping. It got worse. I can't imagine how his legs must have felt the next morning.
Yeah. It was pretty bad for sure. But Lawler, it wasn't long-term effect for him because he would be back against Babalu in June. Well, Manhoff would be back in Strikeforce. It would take him a while. He'd be back in 2011. So we'll talk about more about them in the future. In the next bout, 265 pounds, Herschel Walker in a heavyweight bout defeated Greg. I guess the last name is Nudge. Like, that's how they were saying his last name. It's N-A-G-Y. So I thought it was Greg Nagy, but apparently it's Nudge. I don't understand that.
Maybe they botched it like they did Ben Askren's last name. Who knows?
I guess. I don't know. But he beat Greg Nudge via TKO coming by way of punches at 217 of the third round. Walker had been training extensively with AKA for this bout. He appeared ready. Nudge was only 1-1 coming in. Big opportunity for him here. But Walker looked very loose early on. Kind of a weird stance, like a, I don't know, kind of robotic. Like he just barely moved his feet. He was not bouncing around. He just kind of like stood in the center of the cage and just kind of just moved his feet very slow, or not slowly, but very shortly, I guess, to be the, you know, not much. So that was a little bit weird, but at some point he even did a little bit of dancing. He was talking to Nudge, but kind of weird. And then Nudge goes for a takedown and Walker's able to exhibit some good takedown D. But yeah, I how did you think Walker looked early on? It was kind of weird.
He was weird. I mean, you called it perfectly. He looked robotic. He looked awkward. He was taking short steps. It was very odd. He looked kind of stiff, and I felt right away, oh my God, if somebody actually knew how to strike, he'd be done. Because he just did not have a posture that was a defensive one, but he wasn't in there with a striker. But yeah, I think he looked a little goofy, quite honestly.
Yeah, this is kind of weird, but Walker was able to turn a Nudge takedown into top position, drop some punches while he folded up his opponent. In between rounds, we got to see GSP in the house wearing a Strikeforce lanyard, which was kind of weird, but that was pretty cool. Then in the second round, nice takedown for Walker early on. He looked poised, relaxed, focused. I mean, really good initial showing for the College Football Hall of Famer. And he was able to work some positioning, got Nudge's back. He trapped his arms. Just good stuff, you know, for a guy that was very early on in his career. At one point when Walker had Nudge wrapped up while standing, the crowd started chanting for a knee, which Walker promptly delivered, drawing a cheer from the crowd and a laugh from Rich Chow at cage side, the matchmaker for Strikeforce at this point. So that was kind of interesting. But Nudge just really had nothing to offer him. I mean, Walker was all over him. And honestly, the ref could have stopped the fight towards the end of the second round as Nudge was just flattened out, just taking shots. And then in the final round, Nudge took a couple swings early, but was taken down with ease and beaten up some more. And eventually, in a pretty anticlimactic ending, the ref stepped in and stopped the fight. But, you know, I thought it was a good showing for a 47-year-old first-timer.
Well, I got mixed feelings on this, Phil. Let's talk a little bit about the good. The good is what we talked about. He's 47. He looked like he was 27. I mean, sometimes you have old guys who are in great shape, but they still look old. He didn't look old. It looked like, you know, someone else's body, you know, on his head. It was crazy, crazy physique, tremendous athlete. The same time, he fought a tomato can. I mean, any real striker would have gone out there and done some damage. Now, he did take him down, so that was his game plan. Props to Scott Coker for putting him in there with somebody he could beat. I mean, if it were the UFC, they would have put him in there with Bobby Lashley and seen what would have happened. I mean, we've seen the UFC do this. I mean, they give these people who come in who are who are attractions but not really big MMA fighters, and they put him in there against guys they're going to get beat. So at least Coker put him in there with somebody he would look good against. But he sort of felt weird about the whole thing. As great of an athlete as he was, I felt like it was like a setup fight. It was just like, there's no way this guy's going to lose. The Wrestling Observer newsletter voted it the worst match on the show, their readers did. And I'm going to read a little bit from what Dave Meltzer wrote here about Herschel Walker. He got a payday in excess of $100,000, which went to charity, but put his life on hold for nearly 3 months. Moving to San Jose, away from his business based in Georgia, and training with high-caliber pro fighters. He said it was the hardest training he had ever done for any sport in his career. That's a heavy statement from someone who was a two-time Pro Bowl NFL star, one of the greatest college football players of all time. ESPN once ran down the 50 greatest college football players ever, and Walker was listed at number 3. A world-class track athlete who nearly made the Olympic team in the 100-meter dash and 4x100-meter relays, and an Olympic bobsled racer. And, you know, Phil, I want to talk to you about this. Okay, I'm going to read a little bit what Meltzer wrote, and then I want to ask you about this. Meltzer said, or according to Meltzer, as far as Herschel Walker doing it again, the question is whether he would be willing to give up 3 months again to train. The reality is, at his age, time is likely too far against him being able to become a top fighter, even though trainer Javier Mendez said he could make him an elite fighter in 3 years, and if he was 22 or 23 today, that with his athletic ability, he would become the greatest MMA fighter who ever lived. Now, that's Meltzer saying that what Javier Mendez said. What do you think? In 2 or 3 years, could he have been great? And if he started younger, Phil, do you think he could have been the greatest ever?
If he had started younger, I think he could have been, just because as a pure athlete, there's almost nobody that would be able to touch him, you know? So if, yeah, I could see that. Making him an elite fighter in 3 years, yeah, but he just had too much going on. I mean, he was just too busy. Like, I don't think he would have stopped and made the time to be able to do that, you know? And so, yeah, yeah, sure, both of them could be true, but number one, there's just no way to know, and number two, it just wouldn't happen, and it didn't happen, you know, yeah. So.
I mean, I think a guy like Brett Rogers would have knocked him to next week.
Yeah. I think he would have been better off fighting light heavy if he could make that weight. But yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyways, I mean, regardless, Walker would compete one more time in MMA for Strikeforce. It would be 364 days after this fight, so, and that would be it. Nudge would compete one more time in MMA, losing a few months later or after this bout to end his career at 1-3. All right, we're to the co-main event, 145 pounds. Chris Cyborg defeated Marlos Kunin via TKO coming by way of punches at 340 of the third round to defend her Strikeforce women's featherweight title. Cyborg at 8-1 had won 8 straight bouts, including her first 2 bouts in Strikeforce. Her previous bout had been against Gina Carano and had been the first major MMA event headlined by females. The card had drawn well at the gate and on TV, establishing Cyborg as a viable star. Kunin, 17-3, had beaten Roxanne Modafferi in her Strikeforce debut a couple months prior to this. Widely considered one of the best female fighters in the world at the time, Kunin was a Golden Glory fighter with great striking and ground skills. She was fighting above her ideal weight, but seemed to be up for this big challenge from Cyborg, and seemed like she would be a good challenge for Cyborg as well. But, man, these two, they got after it right away. Some strikes were thrown before a clinch struggled ensued. Cyborg got a trip takedown, which seemed to play into Kunin's game plan as she was a master on the mat. But the champ was able to drop some good shots from top position. Eventually, the ref stood things up, and the two ladies traded some solid punches. Cyborg was just too aggressive for the challenger, getting some really effective punches to land. Her power was just it was on another level, and definitely 10-9 for Cyborg in the first round.
Mm-hmm. I was pretty impressed with Kunin in this round. I thought she did a good job holding her own. She was trading punches, and Cyborg just looks bigger. And even in this fight, she didn't look anything in terms of how big she became physically, but she looked bigger. And I thought Kunin was resilient. She stood with her. She was brave. Cyborg actually made a few mistakes in this fight. Conan caught her. Wasn't enough to hurt her, but I realized Cyborg was the better fighter and won the round, but I liked the fact that Conan took it to her in this.
Yeah, she had a decent showing, and it was clear in the second round she wanted to keep things on the mat where she had a better shot. She sort of rolled with a Cyborg strike early on and stayed on her back, but it didn't matter. The champ was able to pretty much do whatever she wanted, and you could see Conan just had little answer for her, and Cyborg was just kind of was starting to get more confident. You could see that. So another 10-9 round for Cyborg.
Yeah, this round was different than the first because Conan was doing a little bit of the lay and pray. She was trying to get Cyborg to go to the ground with her to have a jiu-jitsu fight. It was a little annoying because it was obvious, and Cyborg, too smart. She wasn't going to do that.
Yeah. But Conan, right away to start off the third round, she decided that she was going to try to take a shot and get in. But Cyborg showed some excellent takedown D. The champ landed some good combos on the feet before the challenger tried for another takedown, which Cyborg stuffed and took top position once again. Things moved back to the feet where Conan tried her best, but Cyborg was just way too strong, way too aggressive. And, you know, that was really it. Eventually, Conan went for a takedown again. Cyborg stuffed that again, dropped some heavy bombs, and that was it. This was just all Chris Cyborg. Conan was, you know, she had her moments in the first round, but she was really no match for Cyborg. And, you know, as tough and talented as she was in the wrong division. She needed to be at bantamweight, and I think Cyborg showed that.
Yeah, I thought she did really well considering that she was overmatched. Cyborg was running through people a lot faster than she did Conan, so I just give her props for that. And obviously Cyborg is one of the best MMA fighters, women's MMA fighters of all time, so
absolutely,
what can you say?
Absolutely. But Cyborg will be back to defend her title in June, while Conan would be back to challenge for the Strikeforce women's bantamweight belt later in the year, which really made a lot more sense for her. All right, we have arrived at the main event. 170 pounds, Nick Diaz defeated Marius Zaromskis via TKO, coming by way of punches at 438 of the first round to win the vacant Strikeforce welterweight title. Diaz, at 20-7, had not fought for Strikeforce since June when he choked out Scott Smith at Lawler versus Shields at a 180-pound catchweight. He was scheduled to fight Jay Heron for the welterweight title at Carano versus Cyborg, but was scratched when he failed to appear for a pre-fight drug test mandated by the California State Athletic Commission. Zaromskis, at 16-3, had signed a multi-fight contract with Strikeforce in October after turning heads at Dream's welterweight Grand Prix, which he had won with two straight head kick knockouts. Big deal there. And then days before signing, the 29-year-old took only 12 seconds to notch another head kick knockout at Dream 12. So this was a big fight between two very entertaining stars. It was interesting to note that Zaromskis had contracts with both Strikeforce and Dream, and Scott Coker revealed that should he win the belt, he would not have a repeat of the heavyweight title situation that we'd seen develop with Alistair Overeem. Zaromskis' contract called for him to defend the Strikeforce belt twice a year should he beat Diaz. Of course, that wouldn't matter, but quite the stare down between these two before they even locked it up. They even touched foreheads, which I was really surprised the referee allowed them to do that. But here we go. Zaromskis came out with a flying kick, which missed. Diaz hurt Zaromskis with an overhand left early on, and these two were trading right away. Diaz reached for a single leg, pressing Zaromskis against the cage, and Diaz kept throwing knees to Zaromskis' right leg. He was really doing nothing to defend it, but I'm surprised the ref let them stay in that position as long as he did. Diaz was doing damage, but really nothing devastating, and once the two separated, after Diaz couldn't complete a takedown, the two began swinging again. Diaz seemed to be getting the better of things until Zaromskis landed a left hand that clearly hurt the Stockton native. Diaz seemed to slowly fall to the canvas as Zaromskis followed up. However, Diaz, as both the Diaz brothers are known for this, he recovered very quickly, held on while the cobwebs cleared, and then they got back to their feet doing more trading. But the reach of Diaz was clearly an issue for the shorter Zaromskis, and when Diaz landed an uppercut, that was the beginning of the end. He started pouring it on, landing shots to the face and the body. Zaromskis was hurt, and his legs were just gone. And a short right to the temple folded him up, and Diaz had secured the Strikeforce welterweight belt. Diaz showed a lot of respect for Zaromskis in his corner afterwards, checking on his opponent, shaking hands with his team. And This kind of cracked me up, but Diaz said, "Cesar Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, mother effer," to the camera, and then followed that up with, "Pardon my language," which which cracked me up. And the other part about that that's funny is, like, and I know he's calling out his gym, but when what was the Brazilian guy that he got in trouble for, like, testing positive for, like, TRT and steroids. I'm totally blanking. I'm picturing him, and I'm totally blanking. He knocked out Vanderlei Silva, like, back in 98 in the UFC. He was on AEW programming with Mike Tyson. I totally am blanking on his name, and that is going to drive me absolutely.
Rashad Evans was on AEW.
Yes, but he's not Brazilian. It was the guy. Oh my God, this is going to drive me insane. I'm going to have to look this up real quick. But when he fought Vitor Belfort, for the love of God, come on, man. But when Vitor early
on, just,
like,
you should have just said the guy got lucky and knocked out Luke Rockhold. I would have known
that guy. Yeah, there you go. when Vitor would knock these guys out, they would be chanting. He would chant jujitsu, and, like, the guys, I'm like, that has nothing to do with jujitsu. Why are you doing that? So that didn't make any light. But anyway, this is different because he's just like, you know, Cesar Gracie jujitsu after he just knocked a guy out. But okay. Great showing by Diaz. Very enjoyable. Just bad idea by Zoromskis to try to trade with Diaz, and he paid for it.
First of all, I had no idea Vitor Belfort was on AEW. So somebody
he came out. Do you know what I'm talking about? He came out with Henry Cejudo and Rashad Evans when they were going to confront Chris Jericho like several months back, and that was Vitor was with him, and the commentators didn't know who he was. Clearly, did not goodness. Know who he was because they didn't call him out at all. I'm like, dude, Vitor Belfort, why aren't you saying who that is? But anyways,
oh my goodness. Well, this was a good fight. I mean, what a great round if you're a fan of fighting, and an even better round if you're a fan of fighting with no defense. I was kind of annoyed a little bit here. Again, I think that these guys were just slugging it out, and they were just attacking each other, and it came down to who can take the most punishment. I think that Nick Diaz did not show much boxing defense. I mean, he's known for being a good striker, or somebody who just overwhelms you with his flurries. But, you know, he got hit. He almost got knocked out in this fight, you know. And I think just because Zoromskis wasn't able to finish him, was he able to survive and clear his head really quickly. But, you know, Diaz is fun to watch. He's got that long reach. He's able to keep people away. He's sort of like a cat who paws, you know, keeps his prey away. So, you know, before he attacks. You know, it was a good fight, but I just felt like it was a little sloppy at times. But exciting to watch if you just like, you know, sort of the knockouts.
A scrap, yeah. It was an enjoyable fight. A pretty typical Diaz fight for that time. And, yeah, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a good fight. So, but Zoromskis will be back in Strikeforce in June. Diaz will be back to defend his title in October in a rematch against KJ Nunes. That is a great fight, and that was a feud between Diaz and KJ Nunes. That was... We'll go into their first fight and what happened in Hawaii, and I'm very much looking forward to that. So that's going to be fun. But that's it. So let's get into the post-event details. No fighters popped for drugs of abuse or performance enhancers after the event. Total disclosed fighter payroll of $301,424. In addition, the Florida State Boxing Commission reported that Strikeforce received a $700,000 broadcast television or motion picture rights fee, as well as $8,003 from programs, souvenirs, and concession sales. Nick Diaz, for the salaries, he took home $100,000, while Marius Zoromskis got $30,000. Cyborg got $35,000, while Marlos Kunin only got $2,000. Herschel Walker got $600. So that doesn't make sense, but when you put it where, I guess Meltzer said he got $100,000 and then donated that to charity. Coker said he believed at the post-fight press conference that Walker donated his purse to charity. So if he only got $600 and donated to charity, that's not, you know, that's not $100,000, obviously. But yeah. Robbie Lawler got $100,000, while Melvin Manhoef took home $5,000. Bobby Lashley got $50,000, while Wes Sims got $25,000. I have to believe that Kunin didn't get $2,000. You know what I'm saying? Like, they disclose a certain amount, But it's clear that, like, these guys had to be getting locker room bonuses. I mean, there's just no way a title challenger got 2,000. Like, it just does not make sense.
Yeah, I mean, if this pay scale is correct, it proves why MMA needs a union. There's too much of a disparity. It's too much. Melvin Manhoff, who, you know, you talked about being this international star, $5,000? Are you kidding me? That's insane. That's ridiculous. Obviously, Diaz, I mean, Lashley just gets that much because I guess he's a name, but there's too much of a disparity, and it's one of the problems with MMA.
Yeah, no, and it's still an issue. You know, it's still an issue. But, you know, I thought it was overall a very entertaining bout. You know, the Herschel Walker bout was not, as a fight, was not that entertaining. But, you know, for seeing who he was get in the cage, you know, it was pretty cool. Good, you know, decent fight for Bobby Lashley. You know, Cyborg and Diaz, and the, you know, fight of the night definitely goes to Robbie Lawler and Melvin Manhoff. But, you know, the Cyborg fight was entertaining. The Diaz fight was entertaining. You know, Diaz in the midst of the greatest run of his career, in my opinion. So, big stuff. I thought it was a good event. I enjoyed it. Definitely more than I thought that I would have. But, Josh, what did you think?
I mean, I have mixed feelings. There was some good about it. There were some things I didn't like. I think the Herschel Walker thing was a little bit of a gimmick. Obviously, he's a great athlete. I think that he's 47. Put him in there with somebody who's a little bit better. He doesn't have a whole lot of time. You know, Bobby Lashley was a bit of a gimmick, but, you know, we talk about guys, if they would have started younger, Lashley, my goodness, he could have been tremendous, I think. I mean, of course, he blows up and gets tired later in the MMA fights, but, you know, he's definitely another high-quality athlete there. And, you know, looking at the Lawler-Melvin Manhoff match, I mean, that was very entertaining. That was an amazing knockout. That's a highlight reel. That's one of those fights you'll remember forever. Diaz put on a good performance. So, you know, I'm sort of mixed feelings. I don't think it was like one of Strikeforce's best shows ever by any means. But, you know, it was entertaining. And, of course, the production values are off the chart. I mean, they're really doing a great job. In my opinion, much better than UFC has ever done in terms of presenting the sport as a professional product.
Yeah, I agree. Although after watching UFC 261 last night, that was pretty amazing to see the way they light the cage and the lighting and all that stuff. I still would like to see more of a platform of like that the fighters enter from a platform. I mean, I think Coker with the Japanese influence did a much better job with the entrances for the fighters, you know, fire going off and pyro and, you know, coming down a platform. I just think it's so much better than the guys like coming out from the locker room. And like, I really think they miss it by not doing that, but you know, it is what it is. But anyways, let's get to our next episodes coming up soon. We're actually still trying to finalize our interview episode for this week. We do have somebody and he's agreed to come on, but we haven't gotten a time locked down yet. So we're working on that. We'll let you know as soon as we do. After that, we will be covering Strikeforce Nashville. Once again, this is one of the most memorable events in Strikeforce and probably MMA history as a whole. Remember, this is the event where you have the brawl in the cage after Jake Shields beats Dan Henderson. So it's huge, a big deal. And then after that, Jake Shields makes his Inside the Hexagon debut, and we get into the brawl and the fight with Dan and all that stuff. So there's a lot of really cool stuff there. Make sure that you are checking us out on social media. You can find us on Twitter and on Instagram at the Hexagon Pod. And you can reach me if you have feedback on the show. I'd love to hear from you. You can reach me at phil@insidethehexagon.com. But with that, we're going to go ahead and ride off into the sunset. We hope that you stay safe and you stay healthy, and we will see you soon.
Running should be simple. Just put on your shoes and go. And yet, when you try to learn about how to get better at it, especially as you age, you're confronted with conflicting advice, complicated workouts, and confusing nutrition trends that just won't work for you. On The Planted Runner, I'll share exactly how to run faster, longer, and feel great doing it at any age because you don't have time to waste. I'm Coach Claire Bartholik, and I went from not running at all in my late 30s to finishing a marathon in 2:58 at age 42, all on a plant-based diet. I've helped hundreds of runners achieve new personal records well into their 60s and even 70s with science-backed training, plant-based nutrition, and proven mental strength techniques. Each episode of The Planted Runner is like a private coaching session on the run where you'll learn from me and the guests I interview. You'll get actionable lessons to help you become a better runner every week and reach goals that you never thought possible. Whether you're training for your first 5K or your 50th marathon, take along The Planted Runner on your next run. Let me show you how your best running is still ahead of you.